In this first hour of the show, we'll be talking about American politics, and specifically, we'll be talking about the state of the Democratic Party in the United States. And our guest for the show is E.J. Dionne. He's a best-selling author. He's a syndicated columnist. He appears twice weekly in the Washington Post and many other newspapers across the country. He is also a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He's professor at Georgetown University, and he is regular commentator on National Public Radio. He is the author of a newly published book, which is titled Stand Up, Fight Back. The subtitle is Republican Toughs, Democratic Wimps, and the Politics of Revenge. The book is published by Simon & Schuster. And in the book, he takes us back to the period before the terrorist attacks of 9/11, reminding us that at that time, President Bush was not doing well and that the Democrats felt that they were in a position possibly to make gains in the elections in 2002. When the terrorist attacks came on September 11th, generally speaking, a lot of people, Republicans, Democrats, said, let's put partisanship behind us. We all need to stand together and stand behind the president. Mr. Dionne says that instead of carrying on in that sort of spirit, Mr. Bush continued with the kind of partisan politics that he had engaged in before September 11th, and the Democrats were very angry. However, Dionne says that it wasn't just a case where the Republicans were smarter politically. He says also part of the problem here is the Democrats just didn't know what it was that they stood for, and that he argues that if the Democrats are going to be successful in the future, they have to be willing to, as the title of the book suggests, to stand up and to fight back and to be very firm about what it is they believe. That's the kind of argument that he sets out in the book. So we'll talk about that in this first part of the show. And of course, people who are listening are welcome to call with questions and comments. We just ask people to be brief so that we can get in as many folks as possible and keep the program moving. Anybody's welcome to call 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-WILL or 9455. Mr. Dionne, hello.
Hello, and thank you. That was such a wonderful summary of the book. I feel like asking you, just keep going. This is magnificent.
Oh, no.
Thank you for having me.
You're the expert. Now, you've got to do the heavy lifting now here on the program. Well, we much appreciate you being with us. And I guess probably it does make sense to do as you do in the book, is to go back and to talk a little bit about what was happening, and particularly how things stood for President Bush before September 11th of 2001.
Right. Well, in the mist, it now seems back in the mists of time. We forget that the most important event of that first part of the Bush presidency was the defection of Senator Jim Jeffords of Vermont from the Republican Party to independent status and giving control of the Senate to the Democrats. And I think that reflected a frustration on the part of a lot of moderates with a president who had done a very good job in the campaign, sounding moderate in his rhetoric, though actually the proposals he put forward both then and then when he got to the White House were not those of a moderate Republican. They were those of a very staunchly conservative Republican. The polls done in August of 2001, Gallup did a poll rerunning the 2000 election. The result was exactly the same, 48% Bush, 48% Gore. So the country, more or less, those are very close. It was basically a split-even country. And so that the president really had not lost his base, but he hadn't added to it, and his approval rating was coming down. And then 9/11 came along. And as you said, there really was this authentic period of reciprocated bipartisanship. Democrats united behind the president. I have a chapter in the book called He's Ours, He's All We've Got. Mm-hmm. And the chapter heading comes from a conversation I had with a Democratic political consultant, very partisan guy, about 10 days after 9/11. And I called him up and I said, what do you think of the president these days? And he said, actually, I went into church today to pray that he be successful. He's ours, he's all we've got. Now, I think if the president had stayed on that track and, for example, had said, okay, I'm for these tax cuts, but in a time of terror we're going to have to spend a lot of money, let's pull back a little bit on the tax cut. Let us not have a sharply partisan tone. I think we would be looking at a country that was fairly strongly Republican right now. Instead, he made a different choice. His choice was to try to win a majority in the Senate, and he used national security in the 2002 campaign in a way that I think helps us explain how oddly 9/11 united us more than we had been before and then divided us in more than we have been.
Hmm. In this particular section of the book, you also talk about the political strategy that the Republicans had in the 2000 election, positioning the president as the compassionate conservative. And you said that, in fact, this was really very shrewd and worked for them. Is that posture, is it done now? Is there no more traction for that, or can he still use that now?
Well, he's trying to again. I think compassionate conservatism was put in the closet after 9/11 and replaced by, if you will, a more martial conservatism. And I think as the election gets closer, with the president coming down in the polls, I think his advisors realize that they need to show some movement, some feeling, which is what compassion is, on issues that affect middle-income people and less well-off people. They're talking more about health care than they have before. So I think they're going to try to rev it up again. But I'm not sure it's a slogan that can work twice, because before he came in, he could use it as a slogan to say what he would do. Now voters have a record to look at. And I think one of the strongest criticisms to be made of the president is on fiscal policies that leave us in a deep hole, spend money that doesn't belong to us, really. It belongs to the next generation, and gets in the way of doing any number of things that might be useful, for example, extending health coverage in the country, and that might be popular. So I think it's hard to do this twice, to use compassionate conservatism again.
Yeah. It seems to me that, I continue to hear people say something like, in Washington today, things are more polarized and more partisan than ever. The only thing is that I feel like I've been hearing people say that ever since the early 90s. And it just seems like every time someone says that and says, yes, and it's even worse than it was last week. And it certainly seems to be that now there is a level of anger directed at President Bush by people on the left that is probably about the same as the level of anger that had been directed at President Clinton by people on the right. And you seem to make the argument that an awful lot of that is anger directed toward the president today has a lot to do with how he conducted himself in the run-up to the elections in 2002.
Right, I agree. We've been talking about this polarization for a long time, and the reason I use the term politics of revenge in the subtitle is I think there's a kind of interaction between, on the one hand, what the impeachment of President Clinton and then the controversy over Florida, and now a counter-reaction on the other side, interrupted by that brief period of national unity after 9/11. And the reason I think it's worse is because a lot of Democrats feel that really did rally to the president. It wasn't artificial. Some Republicans might legitimately say, well, a bunch of Democrats were afraid to confront the president. Whether it came out of fear or patriotism or both, and I think in many cases it came out of patriotism, a lot of Democrats felt slapped in the face. In the book, I recount that when the Democrats disagreed with President Bush's version of the Homeland Security bill, a bill, by the way, he had once opposed and then changed his mind and endorsed, President Bush said that the Senate, meaning its Democratic majority, was not interested in the security of the American people. Now, I certainly don't think that was the vision that Democrats had when they were arguing for their own version of the Homeland Security bill. And when some Democrats, or many Democrats, were pushing for greater international support for the Iraq War, President Bush said, and I'm quoting him here, "If I were running for office, I'm not sure how I'd explain to the American people, say, vote for me, and oh, by the way, on a matter of national security, I'm going to wait for somebody else to act." That courted a kind of reaction in the country, on the liberal and left side of the spectrum, and that's what the president has to live with now.
Mm-hmm. Maybe you might talk about what happened to Max Cleland, because I think that this is emblematic of not only Republican tactics, but just the level of anger that has welled up and now seems to be there operating in the Democratic Party. Here we had a man, a senator, who fought in Vietnam. He lost both legs and one of his arms in service during that war, and somehow the Republicans saw fit to attack the man for his patriotism in that election in 2002.
Right. They ran an ad because Max Cleland wanted the Democratic version of the Homeland Security bill, which had some more civil service and union protections, and not the Republican version. He was criticized for being soft on national security, and an ad was run against him that showed pictures of Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden. Now, that is guilt by association with a vengeance. And to this day, when you talk to Democrats in Georgia, in Washington, and in a lot of parts of the country, just the mere mention of the name Max Cleland creates a kind of rage. You could say there's a trinity of people in this book whom I use to try to explain what happened to us. The first is Max Cleland. The second is Senator Mary Landrieu of Louisiana. Mary Landrieu is a moderate Democrat. In the first round of the election, she cast herself really as a Bush Democrat, supported the president 76% of the time. Louisiana has a peculiar political system. If you don't get a majority on the first round, there's a runoff. So she didn't get a majority in November, had to run again in December, was the only Democrat who could learn from the experience of her fellow Democrats, realized there wasn't much percentage in being a Bush Democrat, and so she actually went at the president in the second round, and she won the election. I interviewed her after the election, and she was really furious with the president because she felt that someone who was a pro-national security, pro-defense Democrat, she deserved better than she got, and I gave me all these quotes, and I called my wife afterward. My wife is an Irish-American who taught me that the definition of Irish Alzheimer's is you forget everything except your grudges. And I told her that I believe that applies to Cajuns, too, after I'd spoken to Mary Landrieu. And then the third figure is Howard Dean, who was the first Democrat to figure out the rage that existed in the party. The problem for Howard Dean is that he gave Democrats a kind of backbone transplant too early, the good doctor from Vermont. By the time the primaries came around, all Democrats were speaking in much tougher terms. And so Democrats who had welcomed what Dean had done started looking around for another candidate whom they thought would have a better chance. They settled on John Kerry, and we'll see how good the Democrats are as the Democratic primary voters are as political pundits in the fall.
I'll have to run that line by my wife and see what she says. Our guest, E.J. Dionne, he is author, syndicated columnist, regular commentator on National Public Radio on All Things Considered. He is the author of the new book that lays out this argument that we're discussing here. It's titled Stand Up, Fight Back, and it's published by Simon & Schuster. And questions are welcome, 333-9455.
By the way, could I say something?
Yes, sir. Sure.
I've always liked my wife's joke. I think perhaps especially in these days, I have to say that this is meant with no disrespect for people who have suffered from Alzheimer's or who are treating people who have it, but it's simply a line about the power of grudges in politics.
I would hope that no one would take it that way.
But I hope not, but sometimes, you know, if you're suffering through something very difficult, I think you do deserve respect.
Obviously so. Let me go back just for a second to the place where you ended up your last comment, talking about the initial success of Howard Dean and how his hard-charging sort of style seemed to grab a lot of people, and the fact that ultimately once we got around to having primaries, it turned out that he wasn't, for whatever reason, he wasn't successful, and now the Democrats have chosen John Kerry. And I think that a lot of people look at the difference between those two men and are concerned about Mr. Kerry's style, his lack of charisma, his kind of ponderous sort of wonkiness. Nothing against the man, but you wonder, I'm sure that many Democrats wonder if he's really got the ability to lead the charge in an aggressive kind of way that I'm sure they believe is what's going to have to happen if they're going to prevail against President Bush.
Well, I think one of the reasons that a plurality of Democrats decided to turn to Kerry is the combination of his own military experience, 3 decorations in Vietnam, with the way in which he talked about it during the campaign. I think perhaps his most effective line during the primaries, which appealed not only to moderate Democrats but also to some Dean supporters, was when he said, if President Bush wants to make this an election about national security, I say bring it on. And every time Kerry says that, Democratic crowds just jump to their feet. So I think that Kerry is an interesting character because there are moments when he really does connect. And one of the best Kerry events I ever went to was in a small town in New Hampshire, right up against the Maine border, where Kerry simply was in a gym at a high school and basically led about 200 or 300 people at him and answered one question after another and didn't leave until he had answered everyone's questions. And it was a setting in which he managed to combine, if you will, the positive sides of wonkery, that is to say he actually knew a lot about a lot of issues, with a certain directness to the voters. I think he doesn't always capture that, and there are times when his language, his rhetoric, seems a little too formal for some people. And I think one of the questions will be, Will John Kerry succeed in recapturing that magic moment that he had in the period from before the Iowa caucuses through the settling of the primaries?
One thing that I have heard more than one pundit say is that when you're in a situation as we are now, where you have an incumbent president who is running for re-election, that before people start to think very much about the challenger, what they have to do is make up their mind about the incumbent and decide, do we want to retain this man? Should he be reelected? And then if they make that decision, if they say no, then they really start focusing a lot more attention on the challenger. Now, assuming that you think that kind of analysis is correct, what do you think, on what sort of basis do you think that Americans, those who are actually interested and engaged and intend to vote, are going to decide whether or not President Bush deserves another term?
Well, first of all, I agree with that theory. I think when there is an incumbent on the ballot, elections are, as the great political scientist V.O. Key once said, retrospective referenda. That's a hard one to say without garbling it. And that people really do, first and foremost, vote on the incumbent. It's how Ronald Reagan became president, that the voters had decided that they were unhappy with Jimmy Carter. Reagan really didn't grab that election until the last debate, when he reassured Americans that he, some worried about whether he was trigger happy or would blow up the world or would be irresponsible. And he used that second debate to say, no, I'm good enough. I'm acceptable. If you want to fire Jimmy Carter, you can use me to do it. And, by a 10% margin, he won over Jimmy Carter. So I do think that theory is correct. And I think the trouble for President Bush now is not on the left. Obviously, liberal Democrats are going to vote against George Bush. What you're seeing in the polls is a real erosion of his support among independents, and a difficulty he's having in fully rallying moderate Republicans. There was a Pew Research Center poll which not only asked, are you for a candidate, but are you for him and won't change your mind? Among independents, 40% were for Kerry for sure, only 32% for Bush. That's a real problem. Among moderate Republicans, if I recall the number right, I think it was only 59% who were sure they were for Bush at this point. I don't think those voters are deciding on the basis of ideology. I think they're deciding on the basis of performance. And I think a lot of Americans are just looked at what happened in Iraq over the last several months and said, do these guys really know what they're doing? I think it was that kind of question that was in people's heads. So that, therefore, I think the key to this election is, there are two keys to this election. One is, do things settle out in Iraq? Do they reach a better point? And the second is, does this economic recovery penetrate deeply enough into the labor force? I think the president's ratings on the economy, despite the recent job growth, still aren't all that good, partly because there's a spillover from the reaction to Iraq, but partly because we lost a lot of jobs in those 4 years, and I think a lot of people in the middle and at the bottom still haven't felt the effects of the recovery, especially in the face of rising health costs and rising gas costs. And so the question is, does the recovery penetrate deeply enough by Election Day?
You know, I'm not sure when this was now, I guess maybe it was a couple of months ago, that someone tossed out this this proverbial trial balloon about John McCain running as the candidate for vice president with John Kerry. And very quickly, Mr. McCain brushed that aside and said, no, I'm not going to do that. But just for that moment, I think some people thought, well, that's a pretty interesting idea. And I'm sure that maybe there was also momentary concern among the Republicans that if, the issue being that if they lose someone like McCain, that they're in real trouble. Are they really, do you think, concerned about holding on to more sort of moderate Republicans, or are they really mostly concerned about maintaining their base, those people who are the most ideological and who are the most to the right?
Well, you know, I do think they are worried about moderate Republicans. The Bush campaign is advertising on the Golf Channel, which, if you'll forgive the bad pun, is not notoriously a home for swing voters. I think that's an indication that they know they need to get some of their Republicans back. I am very intrigued by this McCain business. McCain actually is an important figure in my book, and I deal with him very positively. And indeed, I ask Democrats, why did it take a Republican, John McCain, to make campaign reform such a central issue in American politics? I think that there is also value in a you know, in thinking about McCain, because I think after 9/11, as I talk about in the book, what we're looking for is a kind of progressive patriotism, and certainly having two Vietnam war heroes on the ticket would send a powerful message. If I were to guess, I would guess that it won't happen for two reasons. One is I'm not sure McCain wants to make the leap himself, and secondly, I think a lot of Democrats are asking of this very independent-minded man whether Democrats are better off having him inside the Republican Party causing trouble there rather than inside the Democratic Party causing trouble for Democrats. Mm.
We have a number of callers here, and we'll get right to it, starting with the caller in Belgium, nearby community here, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
You have not mentioned this concept, and it seems to me that the true problem we have with our politics is the fact that there's only two parties. Two parties make the system run good when it comes to voting and stuff, but it really doesn't make for a good mix when you want to get all people's opinions put out, because two parties take diametrically opposed positions, and that's just about it.
Well, you know, this is, as the caller knows, a very old debate. Are democracies better served with two-party systems or multi-party systems? The advantages of a multi-party system is that lots of different groups can find expression for their points of view from way over on the left to way over on the right, and including some people in the middle, you know, many people in the middle. The problem, I think, with multi-party systems is how do you put together governments afterward? And what you've seen in countries such as Italy is a notable case, where they had such a wide array of parties that it became very difficult to assemble governments, and all the negotiations were done by politicians after the election, so the voters were taken out of the equation. The one advantage of two-party systems is that parties have to build their coalitions before the election, and voters can judge, I think, have a better opportunity to judge what this party, how this party will look when it's in power. Is it a coalition of the center-left or the center-right? Is it well out on the left, well out on the right? And so I have thought about this a lot and have lived in and reported on countries with a variety of political systems. On balance, I think that two-party systems can actually have benefits that outweigh their problems. There are some interesting proposals out there from advocates of a multi-party system, one of which is preferential voting, where you could put number one by your favorite candidate, and if he didn't get enough votes, your number two choice would then get your ballot. That would have done some very interesting things in the 2000 election, because one imagines that more Nader voters would have picked Gore rather than Bush.
I really don't want to get into that bag of worms.
I don't blame you.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right,
thank you very much.
We are at our midpoint here. Let me just quickly introduce again our guest, E.J. Dionne. He's a syndicated columnist, best-selling author. He appears twice weekly in the Washington Post and nearly 100 other papers across the country. He is currently a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and also professor at Georgetown University, and as a regular commentator on National Public Radio. His new book is titled Stand Up, Fight Back. The subtitle is Republican Toughs, Democratic Wimps, and the Politics of Revenge, and it's published by Simon & Schuster. I also do want to mention that he's spending some time here over the next couple of weeks traveling around the country talking about the book, and if we have people listening in the Chicago area who might be interested in hearing him and meeting him, he will be in Chicago on Monday, June 21st for a speech and a signing with the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations, and this is taking place at the Millennium Knickerbocker Hotel, 5:30 in the afternoon. So if you're up in that area, you can certainly do that, take advantage of his being there. And of course, you're interested in the book, you just go down to the bookstore and look for it. 333-9455 is the number for here in Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Our next caller here is in Kankakee, and that would be line 1. Hello.
It's instructive sometimes to view presidential elections as analogous to prior presidential elections. Would you compare and contrast, for instances, the coming 2004 election with the 1972 and 1992 presidential elections?
That's very interesting. Let me take one point out of the comparison. I think it is useful. A lot of people say this will be a very close election. It may well be a close election down to the wire, but if you look at elections in which incumbents are on the ballot, they tend in the end not to be close. They can be reasonably close, but not very close, because in the end, voters seem to make a large decision about whether they want to keep the incumbent in, as they did with Richard Nixon in 1972, or whether they want to throw the incumbent out, as they did in 1980 or in 1992. The comparison with 92 is very interesting, obviously, because you have an incumbent President Bush in both elections. One big difference is you don't have Ross Perot in this contest. I think from the polling, if Perot had not been on the ballot, Clinton probably would have won anyway. And in some ways, this election is 92 turned on its head, because in 1992, the first President Bush was generally admired for the way, across party lines, for the way he had handled the first Iraq war, but the economy was seen as being in trouble, and there was a perceived indifference to domestic affairs. Whether that was fair or not, that was strongly held in the electorate. This time, to, I think, President Bush's surprise, he's trying to get the discussion back on the economy, because foreign policy, which he thought would be his great advantage, is not so much to his great advantage. And I've written, and I talk about this in the book, that this president really didn't take out an insurance policy on the possibility of difficulties in Iraq, and that the polarization that developed around this war actually came back to hurt him, at least in the first 6 months of this year.
Okay, let's continue. Next caller is in Philo, and that's line three. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
Greetings.
The thing that I really resent about George Bush is his, you know, anybody who disagrees with him is, he questions their patriotism, especially during the run-up to the Iraq War, where if you didn't agree with him, you were somehow against American national security and all these other things. And I find that very offensive. I mean, my father was a veteran of World War II, and you know, other people in my family have been in wars and everything else. Why? Where do you come off questioning my patriotism? I think there's a lot of anger there. And you talked about that in the beginning, but I think it shouldn't be discounted.
No, I think the caller is right. In the book, I talk about how, for a period in 2002, the Republicans played a very successful game of whack-a-mole, which is any time a Democrat dared pop up to criticize some aspect of President Bush's policies, especially the foreign policy, or to raise questions about what happened on 9/11, there was somebody wielding a big club with the word patriotism on it and whacked that mole right back into the hole. And so I do think there is this sense that you know, among a lot of people who are moderates or liberals, that, you know, they have a right to question. This is a free country. They have a right to question current policies and should not be written off as unpatriotic if they don't. And I think that, again, to go back to an earlier question, I think that did give Kerry some appeal, because it's very hard to accuse someone who's taken bullets for the country of being unpatriotic. And I think he ends up speaking for a lot of people like this caller, who say, nope, we're not going to take that in this election.
Yeah, especially when he was flying air cover for Houston, Texas.
Yeah, there is that. I mean, I do find it odd that there was a whole period when people were asking, well, did Kerry earn his third medal legitimately or not? I mean, first of all, two medals is a lot. And secondly, it just, you know, to question somebody who actually did serve when you didn't serve, I think that does raise questions in the minds of a lot of people.
Yeah, it cheapens the debate.
I'm sorry?
It cheapens the debate.
Right. I think, you know, and I think they backed off that, because I think they do not, if you're an opponent of Kerry's, you obviously don't want to spend a lot of time talking about the fact that he did serve in Vietnam.
Exactly.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
All right, thank you.
Well,
you know, that on this question of the president's service, there was this period not very long ago that apparently the White House was concerned enough about this issue that they saw fit to release the president's service records, although some people looked at that and said, well, this really isn't a complete story, and you cannot judge from them whether in fact he did serve, as you said. Is that something that you think that the Democrats are likely to continue to try to press on?
I think that I think it's one of those issues that will pop up at various moments, and I especially think that to the extent that Republicans raise any questions about Kerry's service record, it will be inevitable that Democrats try to get the press and the public to revisit some of the questions left by those service records. Kerry himself has tried to walk this careful line, which is, on the one hand, he'd really like voters to you know, notice that he went to Vietnam and the president didn't. On the other hand, He has also tried to say, well, Bush did serve in the National Guard. But I think that's something that as voters learn more, they're going to make a judgment, whatever the details of the Bush service and whether he did miss some of these sessions. You know, I think voters are going to have that contrast pretty clearly in their head by the time the election rolls around.
All right, let's go to another caller. This next person is in Mattoon, line two. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I have what I hope is a simple historical question. Republicans were, you know, got into the negative campaigning mode. There was a chair of the National Republican Committee a few years ago who is credited as being the developer of the modern negative campaign, and I'm wondering if you could help me with the name I have.
Lee Atwater? You're thinking of the late Lee Atwater?
Yes. Thank you very much.
In fairness, the Republicans are not alone in running negative campaigns. A lot of conservatives out there will remember the mushroom-shaped cloud in an ad that Lyndon Johnson ran against Barry Goldwater, basically saying that he was going to start a war. So it's not unique to one side of politics. But I do think, you know, if you could look back at the late Lee Atwater, who was actually somebody I knew fairly well and was a charming human being, but was as tough as nails when it came to running a political campaign, he realized that the first President Bush was in a lot of trouble. He was running 17 points behind, and that the only way to win that election was to really clobber Michael Dukakis on the head. And he found a series of issues, or at least you might call them that. Many would say they're not issues. You know, things like Governor Dukakis vetoing a bill requiring the Pledge of Allegiance in schools on the grounds that the Supreme Court had already said the government couldn't do that, and, you know, this prison furlough program. And so, yes, it was a very effective negative campaign run in 1988. And there is this tendency. I mean, I am struck by the fact that Republicans have been very good at saying any negative attacks on us are somehow wrong or unpatriotic, and yet when the time comes, they will be, they will do what is necessary to win, and I think that's what you saw in 1988 against Mike Dukakis.
Next caller is Normal, line number four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I'd like to talk about the vice presidential pick that's coming up. I'd like your opinion on whether you think it's important to pick a regional candidate, for example, somebody from the South or from the West to balance the ticket, or if it's more important to pick somebody that can articulate their message through the media these days. And one person that comes to mind for me is Bill Richardson, a Latino from New Mexico, who I think is very articulate. And I'd like your opinion on that, please, and I'll hang up and listen.
All right.
Thank you.
I think the first rule of the vice presidential choice is more often than not, vice presidents hurt you rather than help you. And so you've got to at least make sure the vice president won't hurt you. I think the last vice president really to help somebody win the presidency was Lyndon Johnson, because he helped John Kennedy take Texas in that election. Secondly, I think that this is a very circumstantial thing. When Bill Clinton picked Al Gore, it was two Southerners on the ticket. It turned out to be a very successful marriage because each person reinforced the other, and the Democrats became very competitive in the South, a region in which they had not been competitive for a while. So I do think it's circumstantial. I'll just go through a few quick names. Richardson is very interesting because he does have a lot of foreign policy experience. He is Hispanic, and three swing states are in the Southwest, Nevada, Arizona, and New Mexico. Dick Gephardt is an interesting figure. I was talking to a Republican who worked for Newt Gingrich who was suggesting the Democrats pick Gephardt because he said when we were in the House running against Gephardt as the Democratic leader, we went through his whole record, and I can assure you we found nothing negative on him, because if we had, we would have released it back then. He's a solid choice. Some people say he's not exciting. John Edwards is a very interesting choice, and it harkens back to the President Reagan's decision to pick George Bush, the person who came in second in the primaries, who developed some support in the party. The advantage of Edwards is he gives the party regional balance because he's from North Carolina, and he really is able to articulate a strong message. I must say, during the primaries, I wrote some fairly positive columns on John Edwards because I think he really did capture something with that talk of two Americas, one for the privileged and one for the rest of us. I thought it was important because he didn't say it's rich versus poor or worker versus owner. It is the substantial majority of Americans trying to find their way up versus a small number of Americans who have a chance to use government to reinforce power in the society that they already have. I think that's an interesting case to make.
We'll continue again. Next caller, we have a couple of people here locally. Next is Urbana and line one. Hello.
Yeah, hi. I'm curious if you include yourself as one of those wimps that we've got to do something about. Yesterday you wrote that Reagan's failures should not be overlooked, and you mentioned the Iran-Contra scandal, and you also said that Reagan could be tough, but he did not go for divisiveness, intolerance, or nastiness, unquote. But as really beautifully expressed in Democracy Now! Over the last couple of days, where they've been going over Reagan's legacy of 70,000 political killings in El Salvador, more than 100,000 in Guatemala, 30,000 killed in the Contra War in Nicaragua. We're really talking about a very, well, let me quote a Medal of Honor winner who gave up his medal in protest. He said, when President Reagan said, "I am a Contra too," I said that he insulted every American patriot when he referred to these killers of children, old men, and women as freedom fighters, comparable to the founding fathers of our country. To me, that's an obscenity. I don't see... So I ask you again, are you one of these wimps that... you had an opportunity yesterday to talk, when you actually brought up the topic of Reagan's failures, to point out the kind of things that people like Negroponte and Elliot Abrams are continuing now in Iraq. What have you got to say for yourself, sir?
Thank you for that call. I'm not surprised that the caller had that view, and I'll tell you what I think. Two things. The first is, in the immediate days after somebody like Ronald Reagan dying, it seems to me appropriate to say, what lessons can people learn from him, including people who are on the liberal or progressive side of the political spectrum? And there are several points I made in that column. One is that Reagan had a skill, because he had been a former Democrat, of speaking to Democrats as if he were one, and that was very critical to his success. The second, which the caller actually, at one point that the caller might identify with, is that Reagan understood that he was the product of and a leader of a movement, and that the right managed to create a movement that was more than the sum of its parts. And if Ronald Reagan could learn from FDR about how to do politics, progressives could learn a thing or two about Ronald Reagan. And the third was to contrast President Reagan with the current president, where I argued that in two areas Reagan showed a lot more flexibility than George Bush did. The first is on taxes, where Reagan did cut taxes very deeply. I was against that. I've criticized that often. But then he went back and raised taxes twice because the tax cut went too far. That's not the kind of flexibility you see now. And I think critically, Reagan at the end showed himself to be open to Gorbachev, and in a way that only Nixon could go to China. I think it took a cold warrior to say, hey, wait a minute, something is happening in the Soviet Union. So the second Reagan, if you will, as opposed to the first Reagan, or maybe in concert with the first Reagan, really did help end the Cold War. Now, I think that as this argument goes on, people are going to speak more and more of the ways in which they disagree with Ronald Reagan. I had a friend who came up to me yesterday and said, why are people saying all these good things about Ronald Reagan? He cut my student loans. There will be the controversy over his Central American policy. I think this is the first round of a long debate. And so I thought the most useful thing to do initially, in the period immediately after his death, that column was actually written on Sunday, was to say, all right, liberals, progressives, let's figure out what we can learn from Reagan, and then as time goes on, we're going to have the argument over his historical legacy.
We want to jump in here, first of all, just to remind people that we only have about 15 minutes left. And again, to introduce our guest, E.J. Dionne. He works for the Washington Post. He's has a syndicated column that's in the Post twice weekly and a lot of other papers. He is also an author. His new book is Stand Up, Fight Back. That's published by Simon and Schuster. He's also a regular commentator on National Public Radio. Before we end up out of time completely, one of the things that I want to ask you to talk about is another aspect of the book, and which you as we discussed earlier, you look back at how the Democrats sort of felt blindsided by the Republicans who, in the wake of 9/11, when Democrats were trying to practice a kind of politics of unity, that instead the president continue with a kind of really hardball partisan kind of politics. Partly they may have been outmaneuvered, but partly you also say the problem with the Democrats is that they're too tentative. They're not really willing to stand up and talk about what it is they believe in, and that they ought to embrace those kind of key traditional values that Democrats always have embraced. So having said all that, what is your advice to the Democratic Party? How should they be? What should they be talking about? How should they be talking now?
Well, at the end of the book, I have two lists, one called the wrong stuff and one called the right stuff. And it is true that one of the core arguments of the book is that Democrats spend so much time saying who they're not that nobody knows who they are. And just to tick off a couple of examples, you know, this argument, big government versus small government. Well, that's a silly argument. People who are progressive and Democrats believe in Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, environmental protection, worker safety protection, a strong SEC. They're for a pretty big government. So the issue is not big or small government. The issue is whose side is the government going to be on? What kind of regulations are we going to have to make the economy work and to make the economy honest, to prevent things like Enron? And that goes to another argument they have: are you pro-business or anti-business? One of my favorite cartoons is an old New Yorker cartoon where two very wealthy business guys are in their plush chairs at the men's club saying, you know, I don't understand it. Every time these socialist Democrats win, I make a pile. So the issue is not pro or anti-business. The issue is, again, what kind of policies you want to keep business honest. Or another argument they always have: populist versus mainstream. You know, some Democrats think Al Gore went off the rails when he was briefly populist. Does anybody think that when he attacked big oil companies or polluters or HMOs and big insurance companies that he lost votes by doing that? And a lot of issues, the mainstream is populist. So I think they need to get rid of a lot of these sort of moldy arguments that are really quite irrelevant and start talking more about how can government be, you know, if individuals are asked to be responsible, how can the government be responsible? Who, as I said, whose side is the government on? Do we want right-wing judges making law? Can't the government promote both personal initiative and self-sufficiency? I talk a lot about GI Bill politics, which encouraged a kind of reciprocity, that we have an obligation to serve the country and that our government has an obligation to help those who are trying to rise up to succeed in rising up. And so I think there is a language which would simultaneously appeal to the caller who asked that fair question about me on Ronald Reagan, as well as to moderate voters who are really not right-wing, who don't want America to become a right-wing country, and who would prefer a kind of progressivism that would unify us and lift us up together rather than to continue with these sort of deep economic divisions.
Next caller is Urbana, I believe. Yes, line number three. Hello.
Hi. Two separate items for you, Mr. Dion.
Sir.
If you keep track of these things, from the Cleland-Saxby campaign in Georgia, Scott Howell, the guy who produced that disgusting commercial of the morphing images,
yes,
he's now been hired in Illinois by Republican Jack Ryan.
So good luck, Barack Obama. We'll see what will happen with there.
I don't know yet, but recent polls indicate that Mr. Obama has a rather large lead. Of course, it's many months till Election Day right now. The second item is widely different. To my mind, the Bush administration is pretty well slaughtering pollution control and resource conservation rules developed over decades, and it doesn't seem to be getting out except from sources like now with Bill Moyers, the Republicans have squandered a heritage, I think probably started by Theodore Roosevelt, in the area of resource conservation and national parks, and then later on, quite frankly, with Nixon for pollution control. What's your story on that?
Right, Richard Nixon is the person who signed the bill creating the Environmental Protection Agency. No, that's right. I think in terms of the Obama race, it is going to be a very interesting race, and I think given the lead he has, I think you are going to start seeing some pretty sharp attacks on him. because if things stay as they are, Obama looks like he's going to win by a fairly substantial margin. In terms of the environmental issue, I think you will see this issue emerge more clearly. One of the reasons you will is because environmental groups are actually one of the best organized set of organizations on the progressive side of politics. I think, you know, that you have to list them along with organized labor as a major progressive force. And what you are already seeing, you know, in some television advertising from and other kinds of communications from groups like the Sierra Club and the League for Conservation Voters is an effort to put these issues on the table. And the caller's right. These are important issues to moderate Republicans. If you look at moderate Republicans, for example, in the Chicago suburbs, these are, on balance, environmental voters. They are voters who actually they are Republicans who have been drifting Democratic over the last several elections. A lot of these old Republican suburban counties are either turning in much smaller Republican margins than they used to or have actually flipped and are starting to vote modestly Democratic. So I think the environment, people who are environmentalists are never happy that the issue gets all the attention they would like, but I think it's a very important issue underneath the surface and that these activist groups are going to lift it above the surface.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks very much for the call. Let's go next to Champaign County, line two.
Hi. Yeah, the earlier caller explored what I wanted to do, which is the idea you're scolding people for, you know, letting 911 not to silence people, and then the Reagan thing is happening. And we'll be watching your column, and I'll give you a lead, which is to go back to Kerry's investigation of the Iran-Contra connection and also the drug running that was going on with it, because I guess the Senate was in Democratic hands at the time, and he was in charge of the commission. And some people point out that he has doesn't have a lot of bills behind his name, but he has a lot of commissions. And that was a rather good report. It, actually, you could have drawn the bill of particulars for impeachment of Reagan out of it. So I'll be waiting to see that as time goes by a little bit and we have a decent interval. One thing, since you are in Illinois, I'd like to point out, again, Moyers was cited, a figure from his show was that in Illinois, rehires are getting 30% less than the job they had before. So what I'm getting at is this economic recovery, and we're looking at these jobs figures, et cetera, et cetera. But it's not making up for what was lost. And it's also, if you look at the quality of jobs, particularly here in Illinois, we have good evidence of really the Reagan attack on the working class has brought fruition, and we're getting people who are hired with much less flexibility, much more flexibility, which means flexibility for the management, of course. I guess there's only a few minutes left in the
Thank you very much, sir. Could I say a couple things on the Reagan business? If anybody's interested, I had a debate on the Reagan legacy on Slate magazine, which you could find back in the archives back in 1997, which gave me an opportunity to say lots of things about the Reagan presidency. Secondly, I don't think this battle over his legacy is finished yet. I guess I'm old-fashioned. I think in the very early days, after somebody like Reagan dies, it's appropriate to be a little more respectful, and then we engage in the serious historical and political fight as time goes on. Arthur Schlesinger Jr., who is no friend of Reaganism, took a similar tack in a piece in Newsweek magazine. The second question in terms of the economy, I do think that what the caller said and what Bill Moyers said helps explain why Bush's economic numbers have not improved that much despite these reports of jobs. There have been some study of the nature of the jobs added, and they tend to be lower-income jobs than the ones that were lost. Secondly, we haven't replaced all of the lost jobs. And third, as I think we talked about earlier, a lot of people don't sense, in the middle and at the bottom, don't sense that their standard of living has gone up. In many cases, because of the problems with health care in particular, they're worried that their standard of living has gone down. So I think one of the tests of this election will be whether people in those parts of the economy really begin to feel some benefit of this or not. And it takes a long time for recovery to reach folks who have been really hurt in the previous recession.
All right. Again, on to another caller. This is Urbana Line 1. Hello.
Yeah, didn't Reagan give us the bailout, the savings and loan? Was that Reagan or not? For $100 billion or more?
Yeah, Reagan signed the bill that opened the way for what became the savings and loan problem, and then President Bush had to engage in the bailout. So the actual bailout happened under President Bush. There wasn't a lot of choice in terms of doing something to bail out the banks, but the initial law was signed by Reagan. But passed with bipartisan support, I must say.
Okay, thank you.
Not to be a wimp about it, but that's just the history.
Well, and I guess to be fair, also you have to acknowledge the fact that while we associate deregulation with Reagan and the Republicans, and in fact I believe the deregulation in the banking industry actually started under Jimmy Carter.
Well, especially with deregulation of the airlines in particular started under Jimmy Carter. There's been, although the real banking, the serious banking deregulation happened later, and the S&L business happened under Reagan.
Right. All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it at that for people who are in the Chicago area. Again, I want to mention that E.G. Dionne will be speaking at the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations. This is actually taking place at the Millennium Knickerbocker Hotel, 5:30 in the afternoon on Monday, June 21st. Otherwise, if you'd like to read the book, Stand Up, Fight Back, published by Simon & Schuster, you can look at the bookstore. E.G. Dionne appears twice weekly in the Washington Post, a lot of other papers around the country. He's also a regular commentator on National Public Radio. Mr. Dionne, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.